The following program was pre-recorded on WFAN. It's time for Hello, My Name is Craig, our weekly candid conversation about gambling addiction. It's supported by the Council on Compulsive Gambling of New Jersey, 800-GAMBLER. Now, here's Craig Carton.
Good morning. Welcome to another edition of Hello, My Name is Craig. For the next 30 minutes, a frank, open, honest conversation about gambling addiction and addicts like myself. Joining me as always, some epic risk management. And right now, sitting in Las Vegas doing work with the NCAA is our buddy Dan Trillaro. Danny, good morning. How are you, bud?
I'm doing great. Was honored to be on a panel yesterday talking with athletic directors from around the country and athletic directors about the importance of education and mental health and prevention of gambling-related harms on campuses.
Great. And also happy to have with us this morning from Rhode Island, John, who's not only a gambler in recovery, but also now works for the Rhode Island Council on Responsible Gambling. And we're going to get into his story here in just one second. Johnny, good morning. How are you, bud?
Good. Good morning. How is everyone?
We're doing good. So let's, before we get to the great work that Rhode Island is doing, if you don't mind sharing a little bit about your story, how long has it been since you last wagered?
That would be January of 2001.
Wow. All right. So 2 decades. That's amazing. Congratulations on that.
Thank you very much.
Very proud of you. I know it came with a lot of hard work and great to see you on the other side and now using your life story to pay it forward to help others. Let's get into your story a little bit. How old were you when you first got exposed to gambling?
So as far as exposed, you know, pretty early. I mean, and it was not this big exposure. Let me just, what I mean by that is, so, you know, I'm a kid and used to watch football games, you know, with my dad, right? So, and he would call, you know, he had a friend and he would call that friend and make a wager on the game, but it was never anything big, you know. I remember as a kid hearing the term, give me five times on Dallas. Well, you know, I learned that five times is $25. So, and I never remember him betting more than five times or 10 times. So somewhere between $25 and $50 is what he would gamble on. So it wasn't this big exposure, a lot of money. It was just something, you know, along those terms. It really wasn't until I would say, you know, around 18 years old plus, when I'm, you know, starting to, you know, I have older friends, right? You know, teenagers, we're heading into our 20s. We have other friends and older friends and start hanging out together. And, you know, I grew up in a predominantly Italian-American neighborhood in Providence. So there were the social clubs, if you were, with some of the older guys. So that's when really I would say my exposure really accelerated where, okay, it's about getting together. It's about gambling. It's about betting the games, betting football. Everybody's got their opinions. That's where it really starts off for me when you ask me that question. That's how I feel. I feel really at that point in that 18, 19 year old range.
And in my experience, you know, places like that are geared more towards, you know, sports wagering than, you know, casino games or cards, although you find your way into that world too. But, you know, it starts off, like you said, a $5 bet, a $25 bet. But typically the wagering in those places, at least in my experience, is more about, you know, the big game on, you know, Saturday or Sunday that guys didn't want to watch together because a couple guys have one side, a couple guys have the other side. There's some, you're busting chops back and forth, a camaraderie, and there's a real huge social aspect of it in the neighborhood, right?
Absolutely. Like, you know, exactly what you just said. It was about the camaraderie. Yep. It was about, you know, busting chops. It was about, you know, the game. It really wasn't about, you know, gambling at that point. It really was about, you know, again, camaraderie, friends, having fun, all that. Now, I will say that it didn't take me long to start betting more money than I had any business betting at that point, okay? But the other thing, though, is that at that point, I was only gambling on football. Once football season was over, I wasn't one to bet baseball or basketball or, you know, any of those things. It really was all about football. It was all about the camaraderie. It was all about that, you know, kind of having that also, in quotation marks, big wheel type of feeling, you know, depending where I was and who I was with and how much I was, you know, how much I was wagering.
But, you know, I want to stop you on that because that's an aspect of this that Dan and I have not talked a lot about. there are a bunch of people I know personally in my life, and maybe I'm meeting another one right now, where the gambling was legitimately, as you just said, football season. So let's just make it up, you know, September to the Super Bowl, you know, end of January, early February. And I know compulsive gamblers who literally only gambled during a football season, were able to stop from February till next September, and then went right back into the action in September. That was unhealthy. And I'm wondering, Dan, if we find now that the compulsive gambler who still limits it to a single season or time of year is no longer the norm, or if that still exists.
You know, it's interesting, Craig. I think about the same thing because, you know, back those folks that I knew, the same folks that you're talking about, before the age of technology, before PASPA was repealed, before sports betting became more accessible, more markets, football was always the sport that, you know, the go-to sport, the most revenue, the most handle wagered in the sport of football. But since gambling was now legalized and normalized and it's been expanding state by state, you're seeing access to markets that we've never seen. And I think we'll see become the case less and less. Whereas in the past, maybe it was harder to get those bets in, harder to make a market, harder to find. I mean, you could find it if you wanted to. We know that. But I think football is always the one, just culturally, historically, has always been the case. But I think that's kind of coming down. I think we're just starting to see more year-round gambling because of the market access.
Yeah, the other thing, John, I want to get into with you before we get, you know, to the bottom of the barrel stuff and then come up with recovery and what you do now in Rhode Island. You know, when you wager in the environment you wagered in, you know, this what amounts to a fraternity, a social club, neighborhood guys who all know each other and, you know, generational knowledge of one another's families and all that, you also very quickly build a reputation. One guy's the mush, he can't win. This guy has the reputation of always winning, right? This guy's the guy, the quote-unquote, and I hate this term, but the degenerate gambler, a term that's thrown around way too loosely for me. I'm wondering... Right. What was your reputation amongst the guys in your neighborhood?
My reputation, and I wanted, this is unbelievable to say this, but I wanted this reputation, was that I was a big player. I bet
Got
big,
it.
And I paid. I was able to pay. I was able to pay my loss, and. And I also wanted the reputation of being, again, in quotation marks, somewhat of a shop, okay? You know, I just didn't bet the chalk.
Your ego is totally out of control, as mine was, where you wanted to bet the most. You wanted guys coming to you for picks. You wanted to be the guy in town that everybody waited to hear what you had to say about a game before they bet it.
Yeah, I like that feeling. I like that rep.
When did it go south for you?
Okay, really simple. It went south in the early 90s, around 93-ish, when Foxwoods was built. Okay, so that's...
Let me just tell people that, for those of you that aren't familiar, for wherever you might be listening to the show, or when you're listening to it, Foxwoods is one of the two major casinos in Connecticut, and when they opened up, it opened up an opportunity for a lot of people that could only go to Atlantic City, New Jersey, if they're looking for casino games, to actually walk into a place. And Foxwoods and Mohegan Sun are beautiful places, but that's what Foxwoods is. Go ahead. Sorry.
Right. So I went to Foxwoods, and I'm going to tell you, the game, and I had never played it before, the game that I went right to and was attracted to, and it started the downfall, was craps.
Got it.
The game of craps had all the components that I needed, okay? The action, the fast pace, the flow, the everything that you could possibly, you know, want for to feed my, you know, my personality, my mania, if you will, craps had. And there was a very, very quick acceleration of, you know, gambling, betting, going higher stakes, and then into, I'm getting to some serious problems here, okay?
Financially,
right? You know, you know, craps and the casino life and going into and driving there. Ultimately, look, I say it all the time. For me, the feeling that I got, that feeling in your gut, that butterflies in your stomach, That started for me when I put my car in reverse backing out of the driveway. The anticipation of backing out, going on the road and heading up to Foxwoods, that's where my high really started. And it went all the way through pulling up to valet, the guys know my name, into the casino, up to the table, all of that. The least part of the whole high of it all was the money. The money really, you know, it became, it really did become secondary, okay? I mean, I would have, I just remember one quick night where to my, and I can picture it today, to my left was a restaurant, a well-known restaurant owner in Providence, and I knew him. And I had $3,600 up on a six, and I hit it once, I hit it two, and I remember him looking at me and saying, John, take that down, you hit it two times. I had no interest in taking it down. I just wanted to see the number six come up again. I just, it, you know, so it really wasn't at that point about money. It was just about strictly action, the feeling, the high, all of that. It was, and that's really where things went south. And things went south pretty quickly for me, unfortunately, and ended up pretty catastrophic.
We might as well share it. One quick Foxwoods story, just to give people an idea. When you gamble at the level I was gambling at, you know, I didn't go to Foxwoods a lot. I preferred Mohegan Sun in Connecticut. I couldn't tell you why, other than I just felt more comfortable there. But when I did go to Foxwoods, you know, like I did anywhere else, you know, significant wins, significant losses. But I only went there maybe, I'm trying to think, four or five times in my lifetime, six times at most. And I remember one day I got a box in the mail. They were trying to get me in. I was now betting 10-15,000 bucks a hand, and they wanted my action like everybody else. You know, they knew where I went. If I did go to Connecticut, it was usually to Mohegan Sun. And then I got a box in the mail one day, and I got a gift from Foxwoods. And it was a gift, they claimed, not tied to anything, no strings at all, just a gift from us. Love you to consider coming back in. And they bought me a Rolex. And like, I don't wear watches. Wow. I don't wear jewelry at all, other than a wedding ring.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is unbelievable. I've only been there four or five times. I got a $25,000 watch sitting in front of me, and they used that, you know, as a way to try to get me in. But before we take our break, what was that catastrophic bottom of the barrel moment or several moments over a period of time that led you to eventually decide that you needed help?
All right. So I mean, let's just get to yes, the cat. I mean, there were a lot of problems.
Let me just say to people that this does not happen overnight. This is for any compulsive gambler.
Right.
This is over a long period of time where you become a world class liar and hider. Your family doesn't know what's going on because you don't include them. You will lie to your wife, your kids, everyone about everything going on in your life.
Yeah.
And it's to be fair, what John's about to share with us is, it is a very slow burn, especially for friends and family members, until we get to the point where we're desperate enough to ask for help. So the story that you're going to share with us, I totally recognize, didn't just happen on one random Friday. This was months and months of Fridays leading up to the inevitable. Go ahead.
Right. All those things you just said, you know, check mark. And then ultimately, you know, I had, unfortunately, I had an opportunity in the work I did to access funds that weren't mine. And ultimately, you know, financial crime is where, you know, it ended up for me. And once that happened, you know, I kind of felt like I turned down a faucet. I did it one time, and, you know, and that's going to be, that's it. I'll pay it back and all that. Once I turned on that faucet, it was over, and you know, ended up you know, getting in trouble, arrested, charged. I ended up getting in trouble, let's see, it was around 1999, 2000, I'm not even sure anymore. But at that point, did end up getting in trouble. I was charged with obtaining money under false pretenses, and I was sentenced to 10 years with 3 to serve. And mind you, this is with a wife and 2 young kids, you know, at home. So that was That's the catastrophe. That's where it ended. Yeah. All the things you just said, went, that was the trip along the way, ending with that piece of the issue.
How much time did you actually do out of the three?
Out of the three, I did a little over 2 years, and the rest of the time of those 3 years on home confinement, and then obviously on probation for the remainder time for those 10 years.
We'll take a quick break.
Absolutely,
we'll get to the other side. Let John tell the good part of the story right after this.
Back to more of Hello, My Name Is Craig on The Fan with your host Craig Carton, and supported by the Council on Compulsive Gambling of New Jersey, 800-GAMBLER.
Hi, welcome back to Hello, My Name Is Craig. As always, epic risk management. Our buddy Dan Trillaro and John, who's in Rhode Island. When we left there, John had got a sentence to go away, spent 2 years in prison, and then another 8 years on probation. But here we are, you know, 20 years later, and he's no longer gambling. He's no longer, quote unquote, on paper, which is how prisoners and people in the system refer to themselves. He's off government paper, living a great life. Walk us through, if you don't mind, the bottom of the barrel moment, just real quick, which I assume he's either hearing the words guilty or walking into prison for the first time. And then let's get to how you figured out your problems. What was it like for you, that one day when you had to surrender?
Yeah, that day of walking into prison for the first time is, etched in my brain, and I'll never forget it. It was horrendous, and I'm not too proud to tell you that the first night in prison, I cried like a baby. Okay, that's bottom line. I cried like a baby the first night. Now, once I got that out, I had to do what I had to do to do the time and to make things right. Now, I had a wife and two small kids. I will give my wife a lot of credit. While everyone told her to run for the hills, she stuck by me. She stayed in the game.
Great.
And I just know, I know that this goes against the grain, recovery and all that. But when I tell you, I knew in prison, I knew that I was never gambling again. I knew that I was never gambling again, and I never did. Now, moving towards getting out, what I also did know is that I had some experience in the mental health field, and I wanted to get involved with the issue. So when I was released, I was court mandated for counseling, and there was only one program at the time in this state, and it was at Rhode Island Hospital, and it was run by Henry Lessier and Dr. Bob Breen. And Daniel, I don't know if you know or Greg either, but Henry Lessier was like a pioneer in the world of problem gambling.
Yep,
he's written
absolutely.
Like some classic books, and he happened to be a Rhode Islander, and he had this program. And so I did, I had to go to them. And when there was two things that happened there. One, I'll never forget, I was surprised at the lack of knowledge they had in the arena of certain, like football gambling terms, casino gambling in terms. What they really knew, as far as the gambling piece, like people who are gambling in the lingo and the language, they knew a lot about, the video slot machines and the random number generators and all that stuff. But a lot of the lingo that I talked about, they didn't know. And that surprised me a little bit, which brings me, I'll talk about that in a minute, to what we do now. But, I mean, they were excellent, don't get me wrong. They were excellent and all of that. They recruited me, so to speak, to get involved with the Rhode Island Council, to work, in the field with my story.
And was there a part of you that was reluctant to do it, where you had conquered it, you decided I'm not betting anymore, you're not betting anymore, your wife accepted that, and as you slowly re-earned trust amongst your family and friends, was there a part of you that wanted to stay as far away from the gambling world, even though there was this opportunity to be in recovery and treatment, or was it easy to feed in the deep end right away?
Yeah, no, I wanted to get into it right away.
Got
What I was reluctant with, and unfortunately was, back then when I did first get into it and they introduced me to the people that I had to, that were involved with the field back then. When I say back then, I'm talking like 2000, you know, five, so to speak. Unfortunately, there was a lot of dysfunction in the field here in Rhode Island for a lot of different reasons, but there was a lot of dysfunction, and that definitely I wasn't interested in, and that I didn't need, okay? So I stepped out. So I did step out for a while. It wasn't until around 2016, about 7 years ago, I got a call from the deputy director of the Rhode Island Lottery, who had met me way back then, right. And she said, we have new people with the Rhode Island Council. We got some programs that we want to start doing. I'd like to, you know, if you're interested, I'd like to have you come back in and at least sit in on a couple of meetings. I took that as a really great compliment, first of all, that she would track me down after all those years. And I did go. I sat there for three meetings and didn't say a word and saw that there was, a clear path to doing something of real value to help the problem gambler here in Rhode Island. And once I saw that, that's when I really did dive in.
And
you know,
do you find that in your experience now with the Rhode Island Council, and Dan, I apologize for not including you as much in today's episode as normal. Dan worked for the New Jersey Council for so long, so he understands what it's like, you know, in the job that you're currently in. I wonder, though, in Rhode Island, are you guys finding that it's easy for gamblers or people who think they have a gambling problem or their families to reach out to you and get the help they need? Or do you find that that's still too long a process from where we want it to be?
Well, there needs to be more visibility of the pro. We need to get more money into, you know, marketing and getting the word out. But I will say, as far as once they do access the services, right. Here in Rhode Island, we have a great program. We have a helpline. Once the helpline is answered, then if the people on the helpline feel as though it's someone who needs to talk to someone right there and then, and they, you know, they're trained to know that, they get warm transferred over to me. So I'm the first point of contact, and I do answer the phone 24/7. So I get a warm transfer. Once I get that person, I'm able to get them assessed and into some sort of, whether it be counseling or peer support. The goal is within 24 to 48 hours.
Great. Dan, let me bring you in for a second. You know, Dan did it for a long time in New Jersey, and now does similar things on behalf of Epic, mostly on college campuses, et cetera, but also talking to leagues, and has really always been there as I meet more and more, you know, problem gamblers who need help. Dan's always the first person I send people to. My question, I guess both you guys can answer, but Dan, let me start with you. You know, one of my issues in this world with gambling recovery is that we haven't adopted a universal or nationwide plan, meaning Jersey's got their deal, New York's got theirs, they're different. You know, Connecticut's got theirs, it's different. Rhode Island is different. Massachusetts is different. Ohio, it's different. And while I truly believe that the people involved with all these councils mean the best, they're doing God's work, they're into it, they get great satisfaction out of helping problem gamblers, everyone's all over the place. Even the amount of time it took to adopt 1-800-GAMBLER as the national number, to me, was crazy. Why can't we come up with a collective where we all agree this is the best way to do it, and we're all going to do it, so that the level of care is not different based on what state you happen to live in?
Sure. Well, I addressed this topic yesterday, Craig, with the athletic directors and a bunch of media outlets in the room. One of the things I said is I point back to the repeal of PASPA in 2018. And I know gambling issues have happened way before that. We understand that. But the repeal of PASPA gave states exactly what they wanted, states' rights. And so the federal government said, you want states' rights, you take them. And now it's up to you to legalize how to legislate, regulate, enforce what policies, including support services for people who develop gambling-related problems. We are now further from where a goal of a national solution is, for the simple reason that each state decides within its borders what will work best. Some states don't have robust forms of gambling. Some don't have iGaming. Some don't have sports betting, sure. Right? So one of the concerns we see, and the 800-GAMBLER as a national helpline is a step in the right direction, but we don't have national self-exclusion lists. We don't have a national set of enforcement for when people feel empowered to threaten student-athletes. Thankfully, New Jersey has a very strong enforcement code. Other
so what
don't.
You're saying, and I apologize, we do have to, you know, end the show here in a moment, but you know, you referenced self-exclusion. One of the first things I tell young problem gamblers is, you know, have you self-excluded? If you haven't, then you're not serious yet.
Right.
It's the easiest thing to do. It takes 5 minutes online to do it. I was under the impression, incorrectly, I guess, that if I self-exclude in New Jersey, that gets carried out amongst all operators nationally.
No.
You're saying that it
not
doesn't.
Not for every operator. Nope. Not all the time.
Got
not
it.
For every
not for
operator.
Every.
God, because I know there's a difference between bricks and mortar, and I've famously told the story that I self-excluded online, and a week later got a letter from a casino in New Jersey acknowledging that I self-excluded from online wagering and invited me to come in and wager in their building.
Right. Yeah.
So, look, I could talk to you guys all day. They're yelling at me to take a break. John, first of all, let me say I appreciate you sharing your story. And I love the fact that you're now paying it forward for a number of years and working in Rhode Island. Happy to have you back on to talk more about that the next time you come on.
I would love to.
Yeah, so let's plan that for the new year for sure. And Dan, as always, appreciate you coming on. And as we get closer to Christmas, Dan, we got, I think, at least one more show here. I know the holidays sometimes makes it hard for people to walk away from gambling because of, A, the need for money, or B, just the need for action, or because the holidays sometimes are not the best of times for everybody. We'll get into that in the next couple of weeks as well. Appreciate both your times very, very much. Thank you for joining
us. Thanks, Craig. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you, John. Thanks, Craig.
All right. Look, that could have gone on forever, and I look forward to having Johnny back. Dan, if you're still there, always appreciate you, buddy. We'll do this again next week, yeah?
That sounds great, brother. You have a great week, man.
And a safe trip back. Coming up next, you've got the now infamous Joe Beningo. Is someone going to get in trouble today? We're going to find out. And then regular programming back, of course, here on The Fan, starting Monday morning at 6 with Boomer and Geo. Have yourselves a great weekend, and thank you for listening to Hello, My Name is Craig.
The following program was pre-recorded on WFAN. It's time for Hello, My Name is Craig, our weekly candid conversation about gambling addiction. It's supported by the Council on Compulsive Gambling of New Jersey, 800-GAMBLER. Now, here's Craig Carton.
Good morning. Welcome to another edition of Hello, My Name is Craig. For the next 30 minutes, a frank, open, honest conversation about gambling addiction and addicts like myself. Joining me is always some epic risk management. And right now, sitting in Las Vegas doing work with the NCAA is our buddy Dan Trillaro. Danny, good morning. How are you, bud?
I'm doing great. Doing great. Was honored to be on a panel yesterday talking with athletic directors from around the country and athletic directors about the importance of education and mental health and prevention of gambling-related harms on campuses.
Great. And also happy to have with us this morning from Rhode Island, John, who's not only a gambler in recovery, but also now works for the Rhode Island Council on Responsible Gambling. And we're going to get into his story here in just 1 second. Johnny, good morning. How are you, bud?
Good. Good morning. How is everyone?
We're doing good. So let's, before we get to the great work that Rhode Island is doing, if you don't mind sharing a little bit about your story, how long has it been since you last wagered?
That would be January of 2001.
Wow. All right. So 2 decades. That's amazing. Congratulations on that.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very
much. Very proud of you. I know it came with a lot of hard work and great to see you on the other side and now using your life story to pay it forward to help others. Let's get into your story a little bit. How old were you when you first got exposed to gambling?
So as far as exposed, you know, pretty early. I mean, and it was not this big exposure. Let me just, what I mean by that is, so, you know, I'm a kid and used to watch football games, you know, with my dad, right? So, and he would call, you know, he had a friend and he would call that friend and make a wager on the game, but it was never anything big, you know. I remember as a kid hearing the term, give me five times on Dallas. Well, you know, I learned that five times is $25. So, and I never remember him betting more than five times or 10 times. So somewhere between $25 and $50 is what he would gamble on. So it wasn't this big exposure, a lot of money. It was just something, you know, along those terms. It really wasn't until I would say, you know, around 18 years old plus, when I'm, you know, starting to, you know, I have older friends, or you know, teenagers, we're heading into our 20s. We have other friends and older friends and start hanging out together. And, you know, I grew up in a predominantly Italian-American neighborhood in Providence. So there were the social clubs, if you were, with some of the older guys. So that's when really I would say my exposure really accelerated where, okay, it's about getting together. It's about gambling. It's about betting the games, betting football. Everybody's got their opinions. That's where it really starts off for me when you ask me that question, that's how I feel. I feel really at that point in that 18, 19-year-old range.
And in my experience, you know, places like that are geared more towards, you know, sports wagering than, you know, casino games or cards, although you find your way into that world too. But, you know, it starts off, like you said, a $5 bet, a $25 bet. But typically the wagering in those places, at least in my experience, is more about, you know, the big game on, you know, Saturday or Sunday that guys didn't want to watch together because a couple guys have one side, a couple guys have the other side. There's some, you're busting chops back and forth, a camaraderie, and there's a real huge social aspect of it in the neighborhood, right?
Absolutely. Like, you know, exactly what you just said. It was about the camaraderie. Yep. It was about, you know, busting chops. It was about, you know, the game. It really wasn't about, you know, gambling at that point. It really was about, you know, again, camaraderie, friends, having fun, all that. Now, I will say that it didn't take me long to start betting more money than I had any business betting at that point, okay? But the other thing, though, is that at that point, I was only gambling on football. Once football season was over, I wasn't one to bet baseball or basketball or, you know, any of those things. It really was all about football. It was all about the camaraderie. It was all about that, you know, kind of having that also, in quotation marks, big wheel type of feeling, you know, depending where I was and who I was with and how much I was, you know, how much I was wagering.
But I want to stop you on that because that's an aspect of this that Dan and I have not talked a lot about. There are a bunch of people I know personally in my life, and maybe I'm meeting another one right now, where the gambling was legitimately, as you just said, football season. So let's just make it up, you know, September to the Super Bowl, you know, end of January, early February. And I know compulsive gamblers who literally only gambled during a football season, were able to stop from February to next September, and then went right back into the action in September. That was unhealthy. And I'm wondering, Dan, if we find now that the compulsive gambler who still limits it to a single season or time of year is no longer the norm, or if that still exists.
You know, it's interesting, Craig. I think about the same thing because, you know, back those folks that I knew, the same folks that you're talking about, before the age of technology, before PASPA was repealed, before sports betting became more accessible, more markets, football was always the sport that, you know, the go-to sport, the most revenue, the most handle wagered in the sport of football. But since gambling was now legalized and normalized and it's been expanding state by state, you're seeing access to markets that we've never seen. And I think we'll see become the case less and less, whereas in the past, maybe it was harder to get those bets in, harder to make a market, harder to find. I mean, you could find it if you wanted to. We know that. But I think football is always the one, just culturally, historically, has always been the case. But I think that's kind of coming down. I think we're just starting to see more year-round gambling because of the market access.
Yeah, the other thing, John, I want to get into with you before we get, you know, to the bottom of the barrel stuff and then come up with recovery and what you do now in Rhode Island. You know, when you wager in the environment you wagered in, you know, this what amounts to a fraternity, a social club, neighborhood guys who all know each other and, you know, generational knowledge of one another's families and all that, you also very quickly build a reputation. One guy's the mush, he can't win. This guy has the reputation of always winning, right? This guy's the guy, the quote unquote, and I hate this term, but the degenerate gambler, a term that's thrown around way too loosely for me. I'm wondering, what was your reputation amongst the guys in your neighborhood?
My reputation, and I wanted, that's unbelievable to say this, but I wanted this reputation, was that I was I was a big player. I bet big, I paid. I was able to pay. I was able to pay my loss, and I also wanted the reputation of being, again, in quotation marks, somewhat of a shop. Okay, you know, I just didn't bet the chalk.
In other words, you wanted Your ego is totally out of control, as mine was, where you wanted to bet the most. You wanted guys coming to you for picks. You wanted to be the guy in town that everybody waited to hear what you had to say about a game before they bet it.
Yeah, I liked that feeling. I liked that rep. That's where
when did it go south for you?
Okay, really simple. It went south in the early 90s, around 93-ish, when Foxwoods was built. Okay, so that's...
Let me just tell people that, for those of you that aren't familiar, for wherever you might be listening to the show, or when you're listening to it, Foxwoods is one of the two major casinos in Connecticut, and when they opened up, it opened up an opportunity for a lot of people that could only go to Atlantic City, New Jersey, if they're looking for casino games, to actually walk into a place. And Foxwoods and Mohegan Sun are beautiful places, but that's what Foxwoods is. Go ahead, sorry.
Right, so I went to Foxwoods, and I'm going to tell you, the game, and I had never played it before, the game that I went right to and was attracted to, and it started the downfall, was craps.
Got it.
The game of craps had all the components that I needed, okay? The action, the fast pace, the flow, the everything that you could possibly, you know, want for to feed my, you know, my personality, my mania, if you will, craps had. And there was a very, very quick acceleration of, you know, gambling, betting, going higher stakes, and then into, I'm getting to some serious problems here, okay?
Financially, right?
Financially. Right. You know, it you know, craps and the casino life and going into and driving there. Ultimately, look, I say it all the time. For me, the feeling that I got, that feeling in your gut, that butterflies in your stomach, that started for me when I put my car in reverse backing out of the driveway. The anticipation of backing out, going on the road and heading up to Foxwoods, that's where my high really started. And it went all the way through pulling up to valet, the guys know my name, into the casino, up to the table, all of that. The least part of the whole high of it all was the money. The money... Yeah. Really, you know, did become secondary, okay? I mean, I just remember one quick night where I can picture it today, to my left was a restaurant, a well-known restaurant owner in Providence, and I knew him. And I had $3,600 up on a six, and I hit it once, I hit it two, and I remember him looking at me and saying, John, take that down, you hit it two times. I had no interest in taking it down. I just wanted to see the number six come up again. So it really wasn't at that point about money. It was just about strictly action, the feeling, the high, all of that. And that's really where things went south. And things went south pretty quickly for me, unfortunately, and ended up pretty catastrophic.
We might as well share it. One quick Foxwoods story, just to give people an idea. When you gamble at the level I was gambling at, you know, I didn't go to Foxwoods a lot. I preferred Mohegan Sun in Connecticut. I couldn't tell you why, other than I just felt more comfortable there. But when I did go to Foxwoods, you know, like I did anywhere else, you know, significant wins, significant losses. But I only went there maybe, I'm trying to think, four or five times in my lifetime, six times at most. And I remember one day I got a box in the mail. They were trying to get me in. I was now betting 10,000-15,000 bucks a hand, and they wanted my action like everybody else. You know, they knew where I went. If I did go to Connecticut, it was usually to Mohegan Sun. And then I got a box in the mail one day, and I got a gift from Foxwoods. And it was a gift, they claimed, not tied to anything, no strings at all, just a gift from us. Love you to consider coming back in. And they bought me a Rolex. And like I don't wear watches, I don't wear jewelry at all other than a wedding ring. And I was like, this is unbelievable. I've only been there four or five times. I got a $25,000 watch sitting in front of me. And they used that, you know, as a way to try to get me in. But before we take our break, what was that catastrophic bottom of the barrel moment or several moments over a period of time that led you to eventually decide that you needed help?
All right, so So, I mean, let's just get to yes, the cat. I mean, there were a lot of problems.
Let me just say to people that this does not happen overnight. This is for any compulsive gambler.
Right.
This is over a long period of time where you become a world class liar and hider. Your family doesn't know what's going on because you don't include them. You will lie to your wife, your kids, everyone about everything going on in your life.
Yeah.
And it's to be fair, what John's about to share with us is, it is a very slow burn, especially for friends and family members, until we get to the point where we're desperate enough to ask for help. So the story that you're going to share with us, I totally recognize, didn't just happen on one random Friday. This was months and months of Fridays leading up to the inevitable. Go ahead.
Right. All those things you just said, you know, check mark. And then ultimately, you know, I had, unfortunately, I had an opportunity in the work I did to access funds that weren't mine. And ultimately, you know, financial crime is where, you know, it ended up for me. And once that happened, you know, I kind of felt like I turned on a faucet. I did it one time and, you know, and that's going to be I'll pay it back and all that. Once I turned on that faucet, it was over, and you know, ended up getting in trouble, arrested, charged. I ended up getting in trouble, let's see, it was around 1999, 2000, I'm not even sure anymore. But at that point, did end up getting in trouble. I was charged with obtaining money under false pretenses, and I was sentenced to 10 years with 3 to serve. And mind you, this is with a wife and 2 young kids, you know, at home. So that was... that's the catastrophe. That's where it ended.
Yeah.
All the things you just said, that was the trip along the way, ending with that piece of the issue.
How much time did you actually do out of the 3?
Out of the 3, I did a little over 2 years, and the rest of the time of those 3 years on home confinement, and then obviously on probation for the remainder time for those 10 years.
We'll take a quick break.
Absolutely.
We'll get to the other side. Let John tell the good part of the story right after this.
Back to more of Hello, My Name is Craig on The Fan with your host, Craig Carton, and supported by the Council on Compulsive Gambling of New Jersey, 800-GAMBLER.
Hi, welcome back to Hello, My Name is Craig. As always, epic risk management. Our buddy Dan Trillaro and John, who's in Rhode Island. When we left there, John had got a sentence to go away, spent 2 years in prison, and then another 8 years on probation. But here we are, you know, 20 years later, and he's no longer gambling. He's no longer, quote unquote, on paper, which is how you know, prisoners or people in the system refer to themselves. He's off government paper, living a great life. Walk us through, if you don't mind, you know, the bottom of the barrel moment, just real quick, which I assume he's either hearing the words guilty or walking into prison for the first time. And then let's get to how you figured out your problems. What was it like for you, you know, that one day when you had to surrender?
Yeah, that day of that day of walking into prison for the first time is, you know, etched in my brain, and you know, and I'll never, you know, forget it. You know, it was horrendous, and I, you know, I'm not too proud to tell you that the first night in prison, I cried like a baby. Okay, you know, that's bottom line. I cried like a baby the first night. Now, you know, once I got that out, I, you know, had to do what I had to do to, you know, to do the time and to make things right. Now, I had a wife and 2 small kids. I will give my wife a lot of credit. While everyone told her to run for the hills, she stuck by me. She stayed in the game.
Great.
And I just know, I know that this goes against the grain, recovery and all that. But when I tell you, I knew in prison, I knew that I was never gambling again. I knew that I was never gambling again, and I never did. Now, getting, you know, moving towards getting out, what I also did know is that because I had some experience in the mental health field, and I wanted to get involved with, you know, the issue. So when I was released, I was court mandated for counseling. And there was only one program at the time in this state, and it was at Rhode Island Hospital, and it was run by Henry Lessier and Dr. Bob Breen. And Daniel, I don't know if you know or Greg either, but Henry Lessier was like a pioneer in the world of problem gambling.
Yep,
he's written like some classic books, and he happened to be a Rhode Islander, and he had this program. And so I did, you know, I had to go to them. And when there was two things that happened there. One, I'll never forget, I was surprised at the lack of knowledge they had in the arena of certain, like, football gambling terms, casino gambling in terms. What they really knew, as far as the gambling piece, like people who are gambling in the lingo and the language, they knew a lot about, you know, the video slot machines and the random number generators and all that stuff. But a lot of the lingo that I talked about, they didn't know. And that surprised me a little bit, which brings me, you know, I'll talk about that in a minute, to what we do now. But, I mean, they were excellent, don't get me wrong. They were excellent and all of that. They recruited me, so to speak, to get involved with the Rhode Island Council, to work, you know, in the field with my story.
And was there a part of you that was reluctant to do it, where you had conquered it, you decided I'm not betting anymore, you're not betting anymore, your wife accepted that, and as you slowly re-earned trust amongst your family and friends, was there a part of you that wanted to stay as far away from the gambling world, even though there was this opportunity to be in recovery and treatment? Or was it easy, 2 feet in the deep end right away?
Yeah, no, I wanted to get into it right away. What I was reluctant with, and unfortunately was, back then when I did first get into it and they introduced me to the people that I had to, you know, that were involved with the field back then. When I say back then, I'm talking like 2005, so to speak. Unfortunately, there was a lot of dysfunction in the field here in Rhode Island for a lot of different reasons, but there was a lot of dysfunction, and that definitely I wasn't interested in, and that I didn't need, okay? So I stepped out. So I did step out for a while. It wasn't until around 2016, about 7 years ago, I got a call from the deputy director of the Rhode Island Lottery, who had met me way back then,
right.
And she said, we have new people with the Rhode Island Council. We got some programs that we want to start doing. I'd like to, you know, if you're interested, I'd like to have you come back in and at least sit in on a couple of meetings. I took that as a really great compliment, first of all, that she would track me down after all those years. And I did go. I sat there for 3 meetings and didn't say a word, and saw that there was, a clear path to doing something of real value to help the problem gambler here in Rhode Island. And once I saw that, that's when I really did dive in.
And
you know,
do you find that in your experience now with the Rhode Island Council, and Dan, I apologize for not including you as much in today's episode as normal.
That's okay.
You know, Dan worked for the New Jersey Council for so long, so he understands what it's like, you know, in the job that you're currently in. I wonder, though, in Rhode Island, are you guys finding that it's easy for gamblers or people who think they have a gambling problem or their families to reach out to you and get the help they need? Or do you find that that's still too long a process from where we want it to be?
Well, there needs to be more visibility of the program. We need to get more money into, you know, marketing and getting the word out. But I will say, as far as once they do access the services, right, here in Rhode Island, we have a great program. We have a helpline. Once the helpline is answered, then if the people on the helpline feel as though it's someone who needs to talk to someone right there and then, and they, you know, they're trained to know that, they get warm transferred over to me. So I'm the first point of contact, and I do answer the phone 24/7. So I get a warm transfer. Once I get that person, I'm able to get them assessed and into some sort of, whether it be counseling or peer support. The goal is within 24 to 48 hours.
Great. Dan, let me bring you in for a second. Yo, Dan did it for a long time in New Jersey, and now does similar things on behalf of Epic, mostly on college campuses, et cetera, but also talking to leagues, and has really always been there as I meet more and more, you know, problem gamblers who need help. Dan's always the first person I send people to. My question, I guess both you guys can answer, but Dan, let me start with you. You know, one of my issues in this world with gambling recovery is that we haven't adopted a universal or nationwide plan, meaning Jersey's got their deal, New York's got theirs, they're different. You know, Connecticut's got theirs, it's different. Rhode Island is different. Massachusetts is different. Ohio, it's different. And while I truly believe that the people involved with all these councils mean the best, they're doing God's work, they're into it, they get great satisfaction out of helping problem gamblers, everyone's all over the place. Even the amount of time it took to adopt 1-800-GAMBLER as the national number, to me, was crazy. Why can't we come up with a collective where we all agree this is the best way to do it, and we're all going to do it, so that the level of care is not different based on what state you happen to live in?
Sure. Well, I addressed this topic yesterday, Craig, with the athletic directors and a bunch of media outlets in the room. One of the things I said is I point back to the repeal of PASPA in 2018, and I know gambling issues have happened way before that. We understand that, but the repeal of PASPA gave states exactly what they wanted. States' rights. And so the federal government said, you want states' rights, you take them. And now it's up to you to legalize how to legislate, regulate, enforce what policies, including support services for people who develop gambling-related problems. We are now further from where a goal of a national solution is, for the simple reason that each state decides within its borders what will work best. Some states don't have robust forms of gambling. Some don't have iGaming. Some don't have sports betting, sure. Right? So one of the concerns we see, and the 800-GAMBLER as a national helpline is a step in the right direction, but we don't have national self-exclusion lists. We don't have a national set of enforcement for when people feel empowered to threaten student-athletes. Thankfully, New Jersey has a very strong enforcement code. Other
states
don't.
You're saying, and I apologize, we do have to end the show here in a moment, but you referenced self-exclusion. One of the first things I tell young problem gamblers is, have you self-excluded? If you haven't, then you're not serious yet. Because it's the easiest thing to do. It takes 5 minutes online to do it. I was under the impression, incorrectly, I guess, that if I self-exclude in New Jersey, that gets carried out amongst all operators nationally.
No.
You're saying that it doesn't.
Not for every operator. Nope. Not all the time.
God, because I know there's a difference between bricks and mortar, and I've famously told the story that I self-excluded online, and a week later got a letter from a casino in New Jersey acknowledging that I self-excluded from online wagering and invited me to come in and wager in their building.
Right. Yeah.
So, look, I could talk to you guys all day. They're yelling at me to take a break. John, let me say I appreciate you sharing your story. And I love the fact that you're now paying it forward for a number of years and working in Rhode Island. Happy to have you back on to talk more about that the next time you come on.
I would love to.
Yeah, so let's plan that for the new year for sure. And Dan, as always, appreciate you coming on. And as we get closer to Christmas, Dan, we got, I think, at least one more show here. I know the holidays sometimes makes it hard for people to walk away from gambling because of, A, the need for money, or B, just the need for action, or because the holidays sometimes are not the best of times for everybody. We'll get into that in the next couple of weeks as well. Appreciate both your times very, very much. Thank you for joining
us. Thanks, Craig. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you, John. Thanks, Craig.
All right, look, that could have gone on forever, and I look forward to having Johnny back. Dan, if you're still there, always appreciate you, buddy. We'll do this again next week, yeah?
That sounds great, brother. You have a great week, man.
And a safe trip back. Coming up next, you've got the now infamous Joe Beningo. Is someone going to get in trouble today? We're going to find out. And then regular programming back, of course, here on The Fan, starting Monday morning at 6 with Boomer and Geo. Have yourselves a great weekend, and thank you for listening to Hello, My Name is Craig.